The From Day One podcast is brought to you by The Bridge and the Made in New York Media Center.
Hi, I'm Nick Bailey, and this is the From Day One podcast. With us today is Dave Belotsky, founder and CEO of Brooklyn-based e-commerce site Uncommon Goods. Dave grew up in New York on the Lower East Side. His grandfather owned a candy shop where his desire to start a business started at an early age. In 1999, while a managing director in a retail industry investment research at Goldman Sachs, he had an idea. The internet was just starting to revolutionize. He'd attended a Smithsonian Museum craft show. What if he merged the two, an online store for artisans? He quit his job, and it was an idea that he couldn't shake. Uncommon Goods launched their online site in the year 2000 as one of the first e-commerce hubs to feature small production gifts and handmade items. Today, they boast everything from jewelry to home accents, many of which are made by independent artists using recycled or reclaimed materials. It's the perfect place for gift shopping, whether you're looking for taco baby booties, whiskey stones, or an avocado tree starter kit. As the name suggests, browsing through their site will awaken you to things so uncommon you didn't know you needed them. The site has continued to thrive despite major competitors such as Amazon and others. Uncommon Goods' success is likely thanks to their commitment to creativity and their curated collections and a mission of social and environmental impact. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So you're now running an 18-year-old internet company. That's obviously a little unusual. How does that feel?
It feels good. I mean, it reminds me in some ways of raising a child, where they say the days go slowly and the years go quickly. It's satisfying. I mean, we've had a lot of ups and downs, and going through the business and looking back where we've come from, it's been an incredible ride.
Where did you think the internet would go back then, as opposed to sort of how it's gone in real life?
I was a huge optimist. I was very confident that the internet was going to take a huge share of the market, and was writing about it from 1995, 96, and decided I wanted to do it rather than write about it.
Were you technologically minded, or were you more of a business, a commerce, a sales guy?
My background was more understanding the customer and understanding how people would choose to shop. And so, no, I'm not a programmer, not a coder, but I understood the interface and the implications and how, in essence, addictive shopping online, how much more convenient it would be than going to stores.
What are some of the first experiences you had with e-commerce that sort of led you there?
Well, the one epiphany that I had was I was going to see a band, and I wanted to get an album, and I was traveling and I couldn't get the album. And then I thought, oh my God, I can just buy it online and it'll be home when I get home. And the convenience of that was really mind-blowing. And I started thinking, why are people going to go to stores? Now, of course, I didn't think of digital music back in the 90s.
Sure. But, did you have an entrepreneurship streak from a younger age? Were you hawking newspapers or hot dogs on the street?
Literally, yes. I was, I was delivering them. I wasn't selling them. But yes, I had a newspaper route. As a kid, I collected baseball cards and sold my doubles to neighborhood kids. I started a lawn mowing business, so yes, I was. And when I was in college,
Aren't you from Manhattan?
So I'm from Manhattan. Lived there till I was 8, and then my mom got mugged in our elevator of our building, and we decided to move out to the presumed safety of the suburbs.
Got it. Hence the lawns.
Yeah, no lawns in the city. Yeah.
Got it. So did you study? You know, what did you study in college?
So I was a political science. Basically, I majored in classes I was interested in. So I took a wide array: environmental studies, a lot of English literature classes. My major was political science. And my junior year, I started realizing unless I was going to go work in some political field, I should get something practical, and decided to minor in business at that point.
Got it. And you ended up working in finance.
Yeah, and that was not my intent. A high school friend of mine, a year older than I was, kept telling me, Dave, you should work on Wall Street. You should work on Wall Street. And I was and still am very idealistic. And I said, Wall Street's not for me. a bunch of blood-sucking parasites. You'll never find me there. And then fast forward, had graduated college, had student loans. I had paid for college myself, had student loans to pay off, and was living with my parents. And as much as I love them, it was a difficult situation. And I called my friend up and said, hey, how about that Wall Street job? And ended up working on Wall Street for 14 years.
Oh, wow. Tell me about, you know, what were some of the things that made you start to think about doing your own thing during that period of time?
So I thought about doing my own thing basically since I was a kid, and I never stopped thinking about doing my own thing. So it was always an itch that I wanted to scratch. I scratched it in college. I ran the university record store and just loved the creative challenge of building a business and growing a business. And I had this pent-up frustration while working on Wall Street, writing about other people's businesses, often thinking, hey, I could do this better, I could do that better. Little did I know that it was a heck of a lot harder to build than it is to critique.
Is it difficult? I mean, I know that, you know, they talk about, you know, golden handcuffs or something like that. It's hard to beat the Wall Street path, right, as a life choice in a lot of ways. Like, is that a difficult decision to make when you decided to switch gears?
So the hardest thing for me was fear of failure. So I was doing very well on Wall Street, and for me, less important than the money was the feeling of success, of winning, and being good at what I did. And the idea of walking away from that and starting something from scratch that I could completely fail at and take other people down with me was the scariest thing. So
when you decide to do that, what are the first things you do? What are the first steps?
So coming up with the idea for the business, coming up with the name, finding people to do it with you if you have enough money to hire some other people, and then finding some space. So those were some of the first things.
What year was that?
So it was 1998 is when I decided I was going to do it, late 1998. And 1999, I took the plunge.
Had you been, you know, the closest analog, I think, back in those days to what you were doing would have been, you know, I guess mail order catalogs, you know, like Sears even or something like that. I mean, there at that point, there was a huge, you know, the 90s were sort of characterized in that side of retail by like these burgeoning empires, like the Sharper Image, Brookstone, of course, the older stuff. That was the model. I mean, if my memory is right, that was the model people had in their heads when online sales started. Did you feel that way? Did you think that it was going to be essentially a more efficient way of doing a mail order catalog, or did you see the possibilities inherent in the medium?
So from a business perspective, what I was thinking of was an alternative to a craft show. So mm-hmm. A craft show only open on a weekend and not very convenient for the seller or the buyer. And so I was looking at it from a uncommon goods perspective as an alternative for the customer to a craft show or a neighborhood boutique. From a business perspective, at the most basic level, yes, it's a catalog with a built-in electronic cash register. And at the time in the late 90s, catalog was 6-7% of retail sales. Internet was effectively zero. And I had written a report as a researcher estimating that it could get to 15-20%. The internet would get to 15-20%. And I saw a lot of the potential, the idea that you would have infinite knowledge or the ability to gain almost infinite knowledge about a product, video. A lot of what's coming to pass is stuff that I imagined.
Got it. Now, there was a lot of people talking about that at the time, and that led to a lot of hype. Clearly, there was an investment bubble and so on. You guys, of course, by definition, have survived that. You know, what were those first few years like? Were you in trouble when the dot-com crash came?
Yes, we barely survived. So we grew to 35 people within the first couple of years of the business. And then as you described in, I think it was March, April of 2000, the internet bubble burst. So it was just 9 months or so after we started the business. And basically, after having recruited all these people, raised money, I had to essentially unwind the business to a certain extent, and we went from 35 people down to 5, and it was brutal. It was harder for the people. About half the people quit that left, and the other half I had to fire, and that was the toughest thing I've had to do in my life. It was tougher for them, and I made a decision after that we were going to run the business in a very conservative way financially from that point forward. And we were scratching and clawing. I took no salary for 6 years, had to invest more in the business. So it was tough. What was encouraging was every year we were growing revenue, and we were still losing money the first few years, but we were losing less.
And why do you think that you guys survived in a way that most didn't? What was it that you guys were doing different or better?
I honestly don't think it was that we were so much better as a retailer. I think it was that we had a low enough break even. I was willing to work for free. I think a lot of it was determination and a low break even. You know, it's kind of like if a plane wants to take off, if you have a long enough runway, you can make it happen.
But the goods business is tough. I mean, you guys have to carry inventory. There's a lot of physical expenses. You know, it's not like selling software or something like that. Had you guys taken financing at the time?
So we raised some money, but not a lot. And by 2000, summer of 2000, people did not want to put more money in the business. So we really had to pretty much go it alone. And we haven't raised any money in the past 14 plus years.
Wow. Was there something to the culture at the time? Did you guys have does Uncommon Goods have a philosophy or a creed that it lives by?
So we have a series of guiding principles, and that's something we formalized in the last 3 years or so, 2-3 years. When you have 5 people, you don't need to have, I have a philosophy, and when there are 5 of you, you're dealing with everybody on a day-to-day basis. As the company has grown, we've recognized we have to codify that, and it's values like each of us owning our role. So that means if you're somebody's manager, let that team member own what they do. And if you're that team member, make sure you own it. So the trying is not enough. You've got to succeed. That mentality is part of it. As a business, really working to be a force for good. So it's not primarily aimed at making money. Making money is a byproduct of taking care of our team, taking care of our customer, and working fairly with our vendor.
Sustainability is a term that gets tossed around a lot in connection with businesses like yours. Do you feel like that word has meaning at this point? And if so, what does it mean to you?
So it means different things to different people. And we became what's called a B Corp back in 2007. And what I loved about what the founders of B Corp established was what I believe to be a true triple bottom line. So the traditional financial bottom line is you have to make a profit. What they added to it was 2 other P's. You have to have a positive impact on people and on the planet. And for most people, sustainability in the common language focuses on the environment. And my feeling is if I don't have enough money to put food on the table, I can't afford health insurance, I don't really care about the environment. I care about myself, I care about my children. And what I love about B Corp is that it gets that, and it focuses not just on the environment, but also on people. And so when I think about sustainability, the way we look at it in Uncommon Goods, it factors all those things in. And yeah, I do think it means something, and I think it's incredibly important.
Does that carry over into the choices of the people that you work with? You guys are, of course, an aggregator of a lot of different people's products and ideas and so on. How do you kind of work that in?
So I would say it starts with where we're located. Okay, so we're in non-hipster Brooklyn in a very industrial area. And the reason we are is because we want everybody at the company working under one roof. So we have our warehouse and our customer service teams working all together under one roof. And the kind of people who will choose to trek out to the industrial part of Sunset Park in Brooklyn.
You're talking about the Brooklyn Army Terminal, is that correct?
Correct,
yeah.
That's not for everyone. A lot of people would like to be in Midtown or downtown Manhattan or downtown Brooklyn. And so I would say there's some filtering for values based on our location. As far as our vendors are concerned, we care a lot about how the product's made, the materials of the product. For example, we will not sell any product that involves killing animals. So we sell no leather, no feather, no fur. And we have a program called the Uncommon Collection, which is a growing amount of our business that focuses on the environmental and social impact of the product that we sell.
Got it. And you guys are curated. That makes you different from, say, like an Etsy, for example. You guys have a more traditional role as like a shopkeeper in virtual terms. Is that right?
That's right. And I think Etsy and Amazon certainly have a place in the market. They're big, they're successful. And I think we also have a place. If you're an artist and you want to focus on your craft, on making your product and not on selling it, not on shipping it, not on customer service, Uncommon Goods is a great option for you. Similarly, as a shopper, if you want to wade through thousands or millions of products, you'll find some amazing treasures, but there's also a lot of chaff that you have to sift through. And so we really work hard at editing that assortment.
Do you feel like you guys are in opposition to the sort of current, I guess what they call the gig economy, or, you know, a thing where people have very tenuous connections to the people that they do business with, very transient connections? Is that something that you're in opposition to?
I wouldn't say that I'm philosophically opposed to it. I think it has a place. At the same time, it's how you treat the people you do business with. If you use them as a tool and essentially take advantage of them, then yes, I'm in opposition to that. But if people have an opportunity to make a good living as a partner of yours in a gig economy type role, I think it can be wonderful. And it is a small d democratizing effect of the internet.
Mm-hmm. How do you treat the people that you work with? What are some of the things that you guys do differently?
So for a number of years, we've been very focused on paying a living wage. And so this year, our lowest paid warehouse worker will earn $15 an hour. We've been very active on a number of issues related to workers' rights. So we have fought for a higher minimum wage. And it's somewhat disarming when you hear a business leader saying, we think the minimum wage should be higher. We're paying, last year it was $14.50 an hour, and we can still make a go of it with our business. Similarly, paid family leave is something that we've been very actively advocating for, and as importantly, practicing in our business. So those are some of the things that we do.
Gotcha. And turning attention back to Brooklyn, tell me a little bit more. How did you guys end up in Brooklyn in the first place? Did you start there?
So we started in my apartment on the Lower East Side back in 99 and quickly needed some space, sublet some space downtown. And then we were in Chelsea up until 2003 in the West Village in a building that has now, an industrial building that's now been converted into condos. We were there till 2007. And we were looking for space, and Manhattan was simply not affordable back in 07, particularly for a company that wanted to keep its warehouse in the same space as the offices. And we had heard about the Army Terminal. It's not ideal from a shipping perspective. The ceilings are fairly low. It's owned and controlled by the city, and it's affordable, and they're looking for industrial-type tenants. And so we found it back then. One of the things we liked, we were looking for space that was safe, that was relatively convenient to mass transit, and was affordable, and also allowed us the potential to grow. And we've tripled in size over the past 10 years, and we haven't had to move other than take additional space.
What do you think of Brooklyn as a business destination? Like, for those of us that have lived in Brooklyn for 10, 20 years, you know, Brooklyn was a place that you lived, not a place that you started a business or you worked necessarily, unless it was, maybe pizza or something similar. That's obviously changing. Have you noticed that? Do you feel part of it? Do you think that's going to continue?
So I think the greatest asset that New York broadly and Brooklyn specifically has is the incredible talent, the people that live here. And New York, you look at the subways, it's very Manhattan centric. And what I found pleasantly surprising is a lot of people who live in Brooklyn don't have the urge to go into Manhattan. They don't view it as the be-all and the end-all. And not having the congestion, not having the tall buildings, being able to ride your bike to work, what have you, is something that's very appealing to people. I think there will be significant continued growth of businesses in Brooklyn, not just one serving the local community. I will say that transportation is a huge issue. The problems we're having with the subway really hurt our business. And I think that's something that really has to get addressed. The ferries have been a godsend. We have a ferry that literally stops at the doorstep of our building. And that's a fantastic advance in the past year.
Absolutely. Do you worry? Now, you're occupying industrial space at this point. And sometimes it seems like industrial space in Brooklyn is a vanishing thing.
That's because it is.
Do you worry about gentrification? I mean, a lot of times people think of gentrification in terms of the former residents, but it's not just people that get evicted. It's businesses, it's manufacturing, it's retail, it's that kind of thing too. Have you seen examples of that happening?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've lived in New York since 1963 and wasn't conscious of gentrification, I would say, until my teenage years. But I remember Soho was once an industrial type neighborhood. That has radically changed. Industry City on the waterfront in Brooklyn is creating a lot of jobs. It is also leading to a fair amount of gentrification. Rents are going up, and it is coming to our neighborhood, and it is a concern of mine. On one hand, you say, hey, you're in waterfront space. The highest and best use, in theory, could be residential. That's where, from a capitalist perspective, you're going to get the most dollars. As somebody who's running a business there, if folks start moving in, they won't want the trucks that are leaving, delivering the packages, running late at night. And it's a conflict, and it's a challenge, and it's a difficult one.
But it's a paradox too, right? I mean, in some ways, there's been this incredible, return to real commerce and manufacturing, even and goods-based businesses in Brooklyn and Red Hook and the Navy Yard in Sunset Park. So those two things are kind of happening at the same time, right?
They are, but it's a different type of business. It is more of the so-called boutique type businesses, and so we're selling products that people want, not products that they need, and bluntly, while we've been very much in favor of the minimum wage going up, having a next year, the minimum wage will be $15 an hour. And if you're trying labor-intensive work and you're competing against somebody in Paducah, Kentucky, who's got a dramatically lower cost of labor, it's a challenge. So I think for high-end merchandise, I think the manufacturing can work, but I think the cost, and I would say labor, and probably more important, the cost of real estate is a real, real challenge.
You guys have competed successfully against businesses that are, incredibly focused on margins and on cost. The two giants of retail, of course, Amazon, which is your most direct competitor, I would assume, at least in some ways, and of course, Walmart, which is the largest retailer in the country. You guys have thrived, despite that race to the bottom. Do you feel like you know why?
I hope I know why. We offer something that they don't. So over a third of the products that we sell, you can only buy at Uncommon Goods. We have had a tremendous focus on product that is exclusive to us or limited distribution product. And I think that's an important part of it. Offering fantastic service. We have lifetime returns. And we focus very much on taking care of each customer as an individual.
It seems like there really has been an explosion of companies that are trying to do something positive in addition to the commerce element of what they're doing. Some argue that for the next generation, right, for the millennials, for the kids today, that they don't even see a line between their values and the business that they're doing or the companies that they create or shop from. And that, at a sufficient point in the future, there won't be such a thing as like for good companies or non for good companies that people will just assume that that's something that they have to have. That's an optimistic point of view. Do you share that point of view?
That was my motivation for starting the company, and that's the way I've tried to run the business, which is there's not a business me and a personal me. I mean, I certainly have a degree of privacy that I try to maintain and professionalism in the office. But as far as the values that I believe in and I live by, I like the idea that I don't have to put them on the shelf at work and I can actually live them. And it's been liberating. And my hope is the world that you describe is our future. We've got a long way to go to get there, but we're trying to do our little part.
Got it. What's next for you guys at Uncommon Goods?
We're working to continue to grow the exclusivity of the product that we offer. We're looking to develop a lot of exciting new products. We have a product design and development team in Brooklyn in our offices. We manufacture a fair amount of product here in the States, some in Brooklyn, actually at the Army Terminal, in fact, with a partner. And so we're working to continue to grow that and drive more of that product. One of the challenges we have, you mentioned Amazon. Amazon will get you a product in 2 hours. And Uncommon Goods, if we're shipping to California or elsewhere out of Brooklyn, it's not so fast. So we're working to speed up our shipping. Amazon also puts pressure on shipping pricing. We're planning later this year to unveil a membership shipping, a free shipping program for membership similar to an Amazon Prime. And that's something that we think will help us compete and help us grow our loyalty.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
You've been listening to From Day One, how Brooklyn entrepreneurs got their start. This series is made possible by a grant from the Made in New York Media Center in conjunction with The Bridge, a news site dedicated to reporting on business in Brooklyn. For more from The Bridge, to learn more about today's guest, or to listen to more episodes of From Day One, visit us at thebridgebk.com. That's thebridgebk.com. From Day One is produced by Kim Thornton, Steve Kep, and myself, Nick Bailey. Audio editing and post-production by Al Sigman. The From Day One logo was created by Joe Meyer, and our theme music was performed by Jody Rockwell and the Ambulamps. Thanks for listening.